Taking no prisoners, this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hello and welcome to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, you know I have a strict policy on this show of never talking about my conversations with world leaders, and I don't intend to break that today. So have I met with the North Korean dictator? I'm not going to reveal the answer because I don't talk about my meetings with world leaders. Do you understand that? So why are we still talking about this? You're out of control. This line of questioning is out of line here, okay? Just stop it. Well, some of you may never even have heard of Kristi Noem before this situation of her complete demolition of her political career has begun. Kristi Noem continued to double down, triple down, quadruple down on the worst answers possible. We started this topic showing you the CBS this morning, the CBS this morning, or CBS, you know, the Face the Nation clip where she was very uncomfortable and I knocked her down to a C+, but she was a fighting spirit. Since that time, she's completely lost the plot to the point where I think her political career is over. And to the point where breaking news right before this went to broadcast, Kristi Noem, the South Dakota governor, has canceled her book tour, effective immediately, canceling an appearance on CNN and just, I guess, hiking it out of town, New York, Washington, wherever she'd been going back and forth on her book tour. She originally, just for a recap, she told the story about how she killed her dog, 14-month-old dog, because it had eaten some chickens and because he was apparently aggressive. We're going to get into that now. New revelations and the way that's been broken down and what she's claiming and contradictory claims. And of course, her meeting with Kim Jong-un. I always have trouble saying his name, North Korean dictator, which apparently never happened. But we don't know because she won't talk about it. And if it did happen, it was part of a congressional delegation, a bunch of congresspeople go. It appears she never met with them. But it's the way she's handling it. She's imploding her entire career. And we're going to break this down today. It's not because whether you care about Kristi Noem or not, it's a reflection of the character of a person, of a politician, of anyone presenting themselves in public and the way they handle adversity. It's easy to go on friendly media. It's easy to just say what you want. When you're in a bad spot, something's gone wrong, and you're challenged and questioned, this is the ultimate failure of crisis communication failure. And as a communication director, most of my professional career, and journalist and speaker and fascinated with this whole line, this story fascinates me, and I'll make it fascinating to you. I'll make this entertaining. Okay, first of all, I just want to start with what's happened. She was the star of the entire Republican Party at one point a few years ago. She was the anti-lockdown governor, tried to take credit away from Ron DeSantis, or I shouldn't say take credit away, but she shared the spotlight with him. And then she faded from the anti-lockdown. And this is when I really started looking into her, because she wasn't. This legislator was never going to let the governor lock down. And they have the documents, I've seen them, proving she was trying to lock down the state, her first instinct. Then the next time she really hit national prominence, I mean, other than all this staged media stuff, and she's an attractive governor, and she's the face of the GOP, and she had presidential aspirations and vice presidential aspirations. She spoke at CPAC, at all these big conferences, was when the women's sporting events in South Dakota, she opted not to take a stand against the trans athletes competing. She said all this circular logic. If it's worth showing, I might show that tomorrow, her appearance on Tucker Carlson at the time, because I think Tucker was really bewildered by her stance. She has a way of talking. She has a way of talking without saying much, and she has a way of reasoning that's completely bizarre, and she did it even back then. You can see Tucker's kind of just, it was confused by the interview. But she does it so convincingly and so passionately that, like when I say I'm embarrassed I gave her a C+ on CBS, the CBS clip we showed the other day, because since she's gone off, I'd probably now, if I watched it, I'd probably give her a D minus. It's just funny how perception can change your view. But anyway, let's just watch what happens. She claims she met with Kim Jong-un, the North Korean dictator. Turned out she didn't. She has to pull the excerpt out of the book. She keeps saying when it was brought to my attention, but she did the audiobook and read it. There's also another anecdote about the French president, which I think will be in here. But just to give you an idea what's happening, the book tour's canceled. Conservatives, the whole conservative activist, everyone's turning against her. Clip one will give you a good overview. Let's watch Kristi Noem. This is important on all levels of politics. Watch and enjoy.
South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem's unfathomable decision to include this anecdote in her upcoming memoir has sparked outrage and also captivated the party, and not in a good way. Former President Trump is reportedly disgusted by the story. Rolling Stone reports today that Trump can't stop talking about it, and he has repeatedly brought up the incident with his aides. Today, Colorado's Jefferson County Republicans announced they have canceled Governor Noem's fundraiser tomorrow, supposedly for safety reasons. But that is not the only controversial story in this book. In the very aptly titled memoir, No Going Back, Noem writes, "I remember when I met with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. I'm sure he underestimated me, having no clue about my experience staring down little tyrants. I'd been a children's pastor, after all." The Dakota Scout, a local newspaper, first cast doubt on Noem's claim here. It spoke with dozens of Noem's staffer, none of whom had any knowledge of the meeting with the reclusive dictator. Sort of the thing you wouldn't really forget if you were a staffer or the governor. And tonight, the governor's team is admitting that the story is not true. Kristi Noem never actually met with Kim Jong-un. In the book, Noem also writes that she spent time in Paris and was slated to meet the French president, Emmanuel Macron. But after Macron called for a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war, Noem claims, "I decided to cancel." Well, the Dakota Scout was on this one, too. The Scout confirmed with the French president's office that Macron never had a meeting scheduled with Kristi Noem. Spokesman for Noem says, "We've been made aware that the publisher will be addressing conflated world leaders' names in the book before it is released." Unfortunately for Governor Noem, both of the stories about her diplomatic achievements appear to be false, but the story about shooting her own dog is most certainly true.
We actually don't even know if that story is true. Okay, so we got French President Macron saying there was never a meeting. Now, keep in mind, she's the governor of South Dakota, and she was in the House of Representatives for a few years. So I'm sure she went on foreign trips, met with people. I myself, as a Senate staffer and as a journalist, have met world leaders. I met Macron. You can watch me interview him on, you can ask me, shout a question. He gives me a strange look. I met the Mary Robinson, the leader of Ireland. I met Vaclav Klaus, the leader of Czech Republic. Shaking hands with Ronald Reagan when he was president. I've interviewed Bill Clinton a few times. I've had Bill Clinton press conferences in the White House. So, I don't think I would spin these into anything funny. I think I'd show you the video. My interview with Bill Clinton was legendary at the first season of Rush Limbaugh. I actually used it for season. It was me shouting to him about Rush Limbaugh moving from radio to TV at the time when Rush Limbaugh began his TV show. And Bill Clinton does a big double take. But anyway, so I think she's just trying to trump up her vice presidential chances with Trump. She's trying to trump up her foreign policy cred, right? Her credibility. This is what's happening between the dog, North Korea, France. This is how conservatives are reacting. And some conservatives that are real conservatives, I agree with, not like the fake inside the Beltway conservatives. Clip two.
Dogs that have this kind of a problem, they are extremely dangerous, and a responsible owner does what they need to do and what the law will allow.
Not a lot of people I know of have gone out and executed their own dog.
Who was her editor? Michael Vick?
How utterly heartless do you have to be to shoot a 14-month-old dog in the face?
You can't just kill a dog because you're annoyed with it. I mean, if I killed every animal that annoyed me, I would be like the Genghis Khan of Kristi Noem's.
She grossly miscalculated and took her political chances to the gravel pit.
I love dogs, man. Don't shoot a dog, okay? It's really?
Congratulations to your puppy at home if he made it through the weekend alive, doing a lot better than Christy Gnome's dog.
All right, there's a lot of snark and sarcasm and humor injected in there. Again, I've known many people that have killed their own dogs, not necessarily a 14-month-old who killed chickens, but I did say on the show, and again, I'm kind of, you know, did I get duped here by her initially here? Because she said it was an aggressive dog that tried to bite her. Well, it turns out the dog didn't really try to bite her. He had one of the chickens in her mouth and she went to reach for it. And the dog was like, you know, and I've had that even with my own dog, got a squirrel in the backyard. They're very protective of it, but they're not like they would attack you. They might, you know, nip at you for a moment if you're still working. It was a puppy. But yeah, I have no problem again with her shooting a dog that needs to be put down. And I'm sorry, a lot of people don't. The people in the clips actually didn't. They think that's just wrong to shoot a dog. If it's an old dog, a sick dog, a violent dog, it's either that or you get a lethal injection, take it to a vet. If she's on a ranch, I could see her doing it herself. The question is, why did she kill the dog? I'm not upset that she shot the dog if it's justly determined that it had to die. Okay. This is Stuart Varney, a show I've been on many times throughout the years. And she got him to turn against her in this violent way. And she turned against Stuart Varney. Watch this clip. It's just, it's not going well. Enough, Stuart. This is Christy Gnome on Fox News with Stuart Varney. This is, it's bad. This is your audience you're trying to sell your book to. And this is the way she's treating the host. Clip 3.
Do you still think that you are in line to be Trump's vice president?
No, it's up to Donald Trump. He's the only person who will decide this.
Yeah,
he's the only person who will decide. And I spoke. Yes, I do speak to him.
May I ask what he said to you about being
no,
vice president?
No, I never tell anybody my personal conversations
with
President
Trump. Did the dog story
president
come up
Trump.
In your conversation with
I talk
Trump?
To President Trump all the time.
About the dog?
About a lot of things. And right now, I tell you what, he is being persecuted in a political hunt. Witch hunt in this court case. So I'm proud of him about how tough he is and how well he is doing.
Did you bring up
yes,
the dog?
Yes, enough,
with Trump.
Stuart.
With Trump. Did you
this
bring
interview
up the dog
is
with
ridiculous,
Trump?
What you were doing right now.
So
you need to stop. It is.
Okay.
It is.
We'll
Let's
stop.
Talk about some real topics that Americans care about.
I'm afraid we're out of time.
Oh, well, of course we are.
We do thank you for being with us.
Right.
I know I pressed hard, but that's what people are talking about to this day.
Yeah.
Governor Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate it.
Wow. Again, this is the friendly media to sell her book. Now, if she had a larger agenda, like she was trying to run as an independent, showing she's, you know, not beholden to conservative Fox News, I don't know what her agenda would be, but there would be a good strategy to go on and piss off every host you need to sell your book. Not that she just needs to sell her book, but those are fair questions. Why are they harping and harping and harping at every show she goes on? Because she won't answer the freaking question. When you ask point blank, did you meet with Kim Jong-un? Well, I don't talk about my private. I don't care what you said. Did you actually see the guy in person? I don't talk about it. Then why'd you write about it? It's just imploding. Let's continue. This is fascinating. This is Victor David Hansen on Megyn Kelly's show. And Megyn Kelly calls her a glam queen. This gets into her looks. Now, I was shocked, and I think I'll have it tomorrow. I don't know if I have the clip today. Her transformation, what she looked like 5, 10, 15 years ago, she looked like a attractive governor, female governor, working hard, and she came across that way. I don't know when it happened, maybe when, after the 2020 or so, but she's transforming herself into what Megyn Kelly calls a glam queen in terms of the hair extension, the fillers, the Botox, the makeup, the outfits. And it's making her look like she's doing a beauty pageant, not a fun, you know, think of Carrie Lake. Carrie Lake in Arizona is, you know, she presents herself as a worker fighter. She's not all dolled up like she's going on a beauty contest. All right, I don't know if I'm being sexist, if this is a violation of Me Too norms. I'm quoting Megyn Kelly, so I'm protected. Let's watch what Megyn Kelly, clip 4, interviewing Victor David Hansen, talking about this transformation. It's all part of it and some other things about Megyn Kelly just says that Christy Gnome is a liar. Let's watch clip 4.
The other thing is, I've watched her career and I don't want to get into a personality, but something's going on there. She doesn't look the same. She doesn't talk the same. Her commercials are different. They're all about
You're
her.
Right.
She, and I don't know what's happened. She's altered her appearance radically, and her personal life shouldn't be any concern for people, but it is. And I don't know what's going beyond, but all I can say, if you're on the vice presidential selection team for Donald Trump, that's the last thing you need right now. And prior to this, she'd been a pretty good chief executive of a small but important state. And she was kind of really played up her out west, cowgirl, hard work. Her husband and she raised this family, nuclear family. But then why do things that just obviate all that? I don't understand it. But natural thing, apparently.
She's gone. Like I'm not opposed to fake hair at all. I got to put a couple extras in here, and I love it. Sometimes they're in, sometimes they're not. She's gone full. I mean, she's like Lady Godiva with the extensions down here, and she's a sitting governor trying to be considered for vice president. It's not professional. She's obviously had a lot of like Botox and filler. It's like a lot in her face. She did a weird ad for capped teeth, which I guess she's also had. She's trying to be like some sort of a glam queen instead of a respected leader.
Well, and it's true. I mean, I don't know what's going on. I mean, again, this reminds me of Sarah Palin in many ways, because Sarah Palin, you go back, you look at old interviews, she was tough on the job. She was competent. And then they pick her for vice president. She gives a great convention speech, and then she goes off and Katie Couric, ABC News, and she was eaten by the wolves, and she was never the same public perception after that, or even anyone's perception of it. It's just, it was like damage. I don't know. You know, maybe it's that rise to national level that, you know, it puts a lot of pressure on people, and they, you know, maybe that's why Kristi Noem's doing this transformation that they're talking about in the interview. The glam queen transformation. I don't understand it. And again, Dan Quayle, another example. He was the vice president of, it was actually the senator from Indiana, picked for vice president, and just, he was very well respected, came across competent, but and then hit the national spotlight and just collapsed. We're lucky that Donald Trump didn't pick Kristi Noem. Imagine this implosion right after he picks her. That would have been a disaster. Okay. Let's continue this. This is Megyn Kelly on Kristi Noem and hitting the media when it's actually her fault. It's Kristi Noem's fault, not even liberal media bias. Clip six.
The nature of the brag is I stared him down. Understand. You know how she allegedly, I have it in front of me here someplace in the soundbite transcript. But I'm sure he underestimated me, having no clue about my experience staring down little tyrants. Oh, you're so tough. You know, you're so... Meanwhile, it never happened. And she's trying to act like she was the victim. She came out with a statement saying, this morning in a 15-minute interview, Margaret Brennan interrupted me 36 times, once every 25 seconds on average. But when liberals go on Face Nation, they aren't interrupted even once. In the fake news media, there are two sets of rules. The conservatives are always treated differently. That's why Americans don't trust the fake news. I resent this. I resent this because you and I both know this actually is a problem with a lot of folks out there. That's not what happened to her. I watched all 15 minutes. Margaret Brennan barely interrupted her. She's counting moments where Margaret Brennan was trying to wrap overly long answers by just doing what anchors do, which is like, she was totally appropriate. I defend her fully in this exchange. And how dare she try to use an existing liberal media bias, which we all know is there, to excuse her lies, her obfuscation, and now new lies about the dog incident, Victor.
Wow. Megyn Kelly on fire, going after Governor Kristi Noem. And I happen to agree with everything she said. And the next thing we're going to talk about is the dog lies, because it shows you the thought process. People are saying that they have a whole new opinion of Kristi Noem now. I mean, this is just incredible. This is the true implosion of a political career. She will not recover from this. You can't. The only way she recovered would be self-deprecating humor. And like at some point, I've had this fantasy it's never happened to me, but I've actually counseled other people to do it. When you're in an interview like Kristi Noem was, particularly like with Stuart Varney, instead of getting testy and trying to shut it down and repeating the same nonsensical answer. Did you meet with Kim Il-sung? I don't talk about my private meetings. No one asked you about what you said. Did you actually ever see the guy? I don't talk about that. It was just in circular logic. You would just dismiss this person as a candidate on a resume, anything, if you're looking for applications. And I know people are probably watching this like, why aren't you focused on Biden or Democrat? No, you got to clean house, you know, first. And this is a major part of the house you have to clean here, exposing Kristi Noem. I mean, I'm pretty much, I'd already written her off for the COVID lockdown, anti-COVID lockdown lies, and also for the transgender lack of courage she showed years ago. But this is now just a new level, and we're watching it. And of course, and I'll have updates tomorrow. I'll show you something. She just immediately canceled all of her remaining interviews and hightailed it out. Here's the funny thing, and I'll hopefully have this tomorrow. She cited bad weather back in South Dakota that she had to cancel the book tour. And on her staff or whatever, the tweet was like 24-year-old radar of some kind of like some moderate snowstorm in one part of the state. It had nothing to do with why you'd cancel a book tour to get home. Even that was a lie. All right. But just to tell you I was going back. What I think at some point, a politician, any politician on any side of the aisle, on any issue, when you're in an interview and for whatever reason, you're failing to answer or, and they just keep coming at you, just stop everything and say, you know what? I don't want to talk about any other aspect of my book. I only want to address this. We're only going to talk about the controversy around whether I met with Kim Il-sung or the dog killing. And that's it. I want you to ask question after question. In fact, I'm not going to talk about anything else. She could have turned the tables and spent just all that time. And then what if she actually answered the questions, it would have cleared up. But I mean, even if she didn't, just keep going the circular logic. Just stick on that. Don't fight the tide. The tide's coming in. She's trying to fight the tide by throwing sand at it. And she looks like a little kid out there just flailing her arms, getting nothing accomplished except destroying any existing or future political career she has. And I would argue she's destroyed her past political career because everything has to be looked at in a new light now. The lady doesn't tell the truth, and the lady can't handle the truth. And the truth appears to be, she should have just come out and said, I goofed. Yeah. This was a story. I had a ghostwriter write it. When I did the audio book, I rolled through it. I just, did my work on voice inflection and I didn't even pay attention to that. I did go to North Korea. I thought the anecdote was funny. I wasn't even thinking that, we never actually got to meet him or see him in person. But it ended up in the book. We're correcting it. Let's talk about it again. What else do you want to know? Yes, I've talked to my staff about it. I missed that. I made a big mistake. This is embarrassing. But you know what? We all make mistakes and I'm embracing this. It'll be making the correction. It would have been over. And it would have still been a ding and a burn on her, but it would have been in a way that she could have survived and it would have been fine. But this next clip is the most disturbing because listen to how she spins this. In the book, she talks about the specifics of the dog got aggressive with her relating to this chicken. But watch how Megyn Kelly dissects it and shows the clip. This is incredible how she turns it into the dogs attacking children because apparently she went after the chicken. The dog, he was like, possessive. She had kids at home. Ergo, the dog had attacked children. Whoa! Clip 6.
And now keep in mind, in the original book excerpt, run by The Guardian, but quoting her book. The story was the dog was, she took it out on a bird hunt. It was uncontrollable. It was disruptive. It was brand new. It hadn't been trained. And that on the way home, she had swung by a friend's chicken farm and the dog, Cricket, started attacking the chickens and killed a couple of them. And then Kristi Noem reimbursed the farm owner for the chickens. And then she killed Cricket with a bullet between the eyes in a gravel pit. And she said when she tried to get a chicken out of Cricket's mouth, Cricket went for her. Which, I mean, frankly, that's not totally unknown by dogs when you're trying to take a high-value reward out of their mouth. It doesn't say that this is a bad, aggressive dog who needs to be put down. So now she's changed it. She did not say in the book he was a serial killer. He was a serial attacker of people or children or anything like that. But here's how she's spinning it now in SOT 16.
This was a dangerous animal that was killing livestock and attacking people. And I had little children at the time. Our operation had many kids running around and people in interaction with the public. And I made a difficult choice. I think you're a mother, too, and you have little kiddos. Would you make a choice between your children or a dangerous animal? And I think I would ask everybody in the country to put themselves in that situation, because yeah. that's what I faced.
Because you put it in a part of a chapter called Bad Day to Be a Goat. And then after you shot the dog, you, quote, realized another unpleasant job needed to be done. Walking back up to the yard, I spotted our billy goat. You said he smelled and would chase kids, so you took him to the gravel pit and shot him twice. How do you justify that? How was the goat a threat? And I'm asking you this because it seems like you're celebrating the killing of the animals.
Not at all. This has been a story that my political opponents have tried to use against me for years. It's well known in South Dakota, and it has been to other people. And I want the truth to be out there and to understand that these animals were attacking my children.
What? They were. Now we've gone to the cricket was attacking the children, killing livestock. Okay, a couple of chickens got eaten, and attacking people as a it snapped at her when she tried to take the chicken, but she's inflated. She's lying, Victor. She lied about Kim Jong-un. She lied about Emmanuel Macron to the point where the publisher is now correcting those two excerpts. And she lied there to Margaret Brennan, in my opinion, seems very clear.
Well, now, you know, it semantically to defend her there, she was saying that the billy goat was chasing kids, which is a sort of form of an attack, and the dog could attack kids. So animals that attack, she gets rid of. You could almost give her a little rhetorical flourish there, but she's just trying so hard to like not be a real person and answer this. It's just all this weird answers and circular logic. You know, I don't know. She sort of just said, the dog had to go. I made the decision. I don't know. It's hard to say. Anyway, I think her career is toast. I don't think you can come back from this unless she has some kind of, you know, uncanceled tour and something. But I think it's cut into like who she is as a person and her whole image. She has to reinvent herself. So anyway, all right. I'm sure I spent too much time for some of you on that topic, but it's a fascinating story. And it's officially over in terms of her, all these cringy interviews because she's canceled the book tour. I may have a couple little cleanup things on it tomorrow. But anyway, we got to take a break. When we come back, Andrew Monford of Net Zero Watch, based in Scotland, is going to talk to us about European green madness. What is going on in Europe? We'll get an update. The farmers, transportation, and energy policy in Europe. How the net zero goals are going. Andrew Monford will be on Unleashed with Mark Morano and TNT. We'll be right back after these messages.
TNT's Patrick Henningsen.
All the focus of the West, of Washington and its allies, are all focused on Israel right now to support and help Israel and to somehow contain and deter Iran. Okay. So that means that Russia kind of has an open field with regards to what it wants to do. So think about that for a moment. Could we have a situation in this new world, this multipolar world, where the Iranians and the Russians, they're allies, and certainly Russia's not going to slap Iran on the wrist for this latest salvo against Israel? Why? Because it absolutely ties up the United States and its allies right now in the Middle East.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT radio listeners rely on TNT radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Are you sitting comfortably?
Oh, yes, yes.
Then I'll begin.
Even when you're just sitting around, we're rocking the talk.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Oh, I'm back. Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining the program now is Andrew Mumford of the UK Watch. He's based in Scotland, and he's also the author of The Hockey Stick Illusion, about Michael Mann's famous temperature chart. Welcome to the program, Andrew. Happy to have you on today.
It's lovely to be here.
Well, let's start actually with the hockey stick illusion. Now, this is your book came out in 2015, but it's really is vital today. I'm going to tell you something that I don't know if you're aware of, that this whole idea of erasing the past is happening again in the United States. But first of all, tell us a little bit about what led you to write that book, The Hockey Stick Illusion. Michael Mann, of course, was a lead UN author. It was 2001 UN climate report. They featured the hockey stick, which showed Northern Hemisphere temperatures flat until the 20th century and then jumped off like a hockey stick chart. And if you, 1990 UN report had showed the medieval warm period much warmer than current temperatures. So go ahead and tell us what led you to write that book. And
well,
what was the illusion of that?
Okay, so I mean, you're probably aware, Mark, and I imagine quite a lot of your viewers are, of Steve McIntyre's blog about the paleoclimate studies. I was an avid reader of his blog. And I can remember reading one particular article that just made my jaw drop. And so I thought, I'm going to write something about this because I have a background in scientific writing. My strength is converting those highly technical things into something that hopefully the educated layman could study. So I thought I'll write something about this one article. Now I had a tiny blog at the time, which had about 100 readers a week. I mean, it was minute. Suddenly, after that article came out, I got 30,000 readers the following day, and I went, okay, there's something in this. So I then started writing some more things about it, and then I decided that I would turn it into a book. So I had small children at the time. So I used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and write this book until 7 o'clock when the kids got up. And I finished writing it and I sent it off to Steve McIntyre and his colleague Ross McKittrick and said, what do you think, guys? And they liked it. And in fact, Ross McKittrick found me a publisher. And then the book actually came out it came out about 2 weeks after ClimateGate. You remember the story when we had all the emails released from the University of East Anglia, all these scientists, talking about all the bad things they were going to do, hiding data and sort of, maligning other scientists and getting people fired and all this sort of stuff. And this was all the people in my book. So, the book was a great, great success as a result. And suddenly I kind of became somebody who was known on the climate front. And eventually that it became my job. So I've come a long way, I guess.
Yes. What happened was the backstory too. I was working in the U.S. Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. We had a hearing in 2006 where we had a scientist named David Deming come speak. He was a geologist, and he had just had some climate work published in the journal Nature back in the mid 1990s. And he was approached by a UN-affiliated scientist who said, after he had his big study published in the, I believe it was Journal Nature, that, quote, we have to get rid of the medieval warm period. This is what another UN scientist said to a climate scientist who was publishing in a journal. And the question is, why did they have to get rid of that? Remember, the first UN report showed the medieval warm period much warmer than current temperatures. The hockey stick took the medieval warm period, flattened out Little Ice Age, and then rate current temperatures up here, like the blade of a hockey stick. Yeah. So his name was David Deming, and he detailed how this happened. And then lo and behold, they did get rid of the medieval warm period and they came up with this hockey stick. Why was it so important to get rid of that medieval warm period, especially from the first UN report?
Yeah. So if you're trying to convince people that something scary is going on, if they're going to look back at medieval times and see that it was as warm, if not warmer then they're not going to be frightened. So that's why they had to get rid of the medieval warm period. And I included the story about David Deming in the book because it is a great little anecdote. So yeah, that's why they did it. And you can see by the way that they tried to protect the hockey stick in the years afterwards, that, you know, this became really important to them. Not just because they had managed to remove the medieval warm period and make things look much worse than perhaps they really were, but also because of all the bad things that they'd done to protect it, they had to then keep that going and keep trying to protect it. And yeah, so the thing went on for years and years and years until eventually the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, just pushed the paleoclimate studies into the background a little bit, and they don't rely on it anymore. So, you know, they've now moved on to other things like, you know, this myth, fairy story, if you like, that extreme weather is getting worse. Yeah, that is where the fear is coming from now. And they just really don't like to talk about the medieval warm period or the, you know, the Roman warming period or the Minoan warm period. You know, they don't like to talk about any of these things. It's just, you know, the myth of the climate emergency today is what it's all about.
Yeah, well, here's a part that you may not know is in the U.S., the Biden administration, the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, has a heat wave index going back to 1930s. And in this U.S. database, it's the continental U.S., it shows the heat wave index, the EPA chart shows, it looks like the medieval warm period, 8 to 10 times hotter than any heat waves since the 1930s, including today's heat waves in the U.S. So this data, EPA came out, Biden EPA came out with a chart that said heat wave is getting worse in the U.S. My first thought is, how is that possible? They started the date in 1960, which is one of the cooler periods of the 20th century, all the way up to the late 70s with cooling. And they said, look at the heat waves, and they changed the scale. Had they gone back to the 1930s, they would have shown a precipitous drop in the heat waves. Well, here's the part you may not know. A scientist named Andrew Dessler from the University of Texas A&M announced on his Twitter feed that essentially it's time to get rid of the 1930s heat waves in the United States for the exact same reason that they had to get rid of the medieval warm period, because it was inconvenient to sell unprecedented heat waves here in the U.S. when the own data from the Biden administration's EPA shows them much higher. Does it surprise you that this kind of stuff is still going on today, that if a scientist sees data that counters the narrative, their first goal is to literally get rid of it, in quotes?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. This has been going on for so long that you know, almost nothing they can do will surprise me any longer. But I mean, they are going to have to do a lot of work if they are going to try to keep this narrative of fear going. I don't know whether you're aware of, there's quite a well-known table in the IPCC report itself, table 12.12, which lists all the meteorological phenomena and whether they've been able to detect a trend in any of them. And for pretty much all of them, with only one or two exceptions, they can't find a trend at all. So anybody who looks at that, the official science, will not be frightened. They'll go, okay, heat waves are getting a little bit worse, and cold waves, well, we're having fewer of those, but that's good, isn't it? Yeah, they really, I think the wheels are starting to come off the narrative of fear now. Nobody's frightened anymore, are they? I mean, we've heard about the climate emergency for so long, but anybody who looks around them goes, well, it's just weather, isn't it? You know, it's much the same as it's always been.
Yeah, in fact, at the U.S. here, we have a new poll from Monmouth University, just came out a few days ago. Support for climate action has softened due to a drop in the sense of urgency on the issue, particularly among young adults. So it looks like the Greta Thunberg movement is failing. Young adults, and it's like a 10% drop just in the last year. What do you attribute a rise of that? I don't know if there's something similar is happening in Europe. But is it, to me, it's because people are losing faith. Part of the reason is people are losing faith in these institutions scaremongering. And a lot of that to me comes from after COVID. You know, before COVID, people could appeal to NASA, you know, the UK Met Office as authorities, and you can't challenge it. They say climate's a crisis. Why can't you? You're not a scientist and blah, blah, blah. After the public health debacle of COVID and lockdowns and mask mandates and vaccines and all the fear mongering, people are more willing to accept the fact that big government related institutions are willing to juice the studies in order for politics. And I think that's contributed to a rise in skepticism. How is that view in Europe? Does that sound like that's plausible in Europe too?
Absolutely right. Yeah, this is definitely happening here too. I mean, as soon as the questions about COVID and the vaccine started to appear, my instant thought was this will play in our favor on the climate front because people will stop trusting the scientists. And, you know, as the evidence of vaccine damages comes on and people start walking away from all the things they'd said about the vaccines before, that is going to keep playing into our hands. There is another aspect to this as well, though. You know, we've been saying for a number of years that climate catastrophism is essentially a secular religion. And you used the word faith about it, you know, faith in scientists, but there is also faith in climate catastrophism as a religion. And people believe it instinctively without thinking consciously about it. It's just, you know, there's fear there. I need to do something about the fear. We've always said that the thing that was going to deal with that was going to break that faith in the climate religion was going to be economic pain. And in Europe now, the economic pain is hitting really quite hard. You have things quite easy over there in the States. You've fracked for gas. Fossil fuel prices are low there. We refuse to do it. We closed down our shale gas industry before it could get off the ground. We closed down coal bed methane. We're in the process of closing down the North Sea. And then we've had the Ukraine war with energy prices going through the ceiling. And all of a sudden, people everywhere right across Europe are feeling the economic pain. And they're starting to ask themselves, I think, questions about why this is happening. And I think they are putting two and two together and thinking this climate catastrophism stuff, the net zero stuff, is actually something we need to actually look a bit harder at, think about rationally, rather than just taking it on faith, if you like.
Yeah, I was amazed. The UK fires report, I believe that was 2019. It was partially government funded. This was the report that said we need to treat carbon dioxide similar to asbestos. So what humans exhale, they want to treat. They wanted to have like radical reductions in flight, radical reductions in meat eating. It was just really a truly bonkers report. I read, I think it was forgive my ignorance. It was either the House of Lords transcript about the debate about this UK fires net zero report. And what struck me is it seemed like even the conservative members of UK government officials all accepted the premise of a climate crisis and the premise that net zero was necessary. And people just pushed back on some of the extremes, but not any of the actual narrative or premise. Is that still the case in the UK today or in throughout Europe? Are the politicians just neutered from ever even challenging the claim of a climate crisis and or the net zero as a perceived solution? Or, you know, are there a few politicians or is it generally, you know, because even your prime minister, Rishi Sunak, seems very weak on the issue overall, although he seems to be getting better.
Yeah, that's pretty much right. The overwhelming majority of politicians in every party are right behind the climate crisis idea, the climate crisis fairy tale, you might say. They're right behind the idea of net zero, and they don't want to question it. There is a small-ish group within the Conservative Party called the Net Zero Scrutiny Group, which is much more sceptical. And they do try to ask questions, but they're a small caucus and they really can't make a lot of difference. And, you know, the thing is in our parliamentary system, if you want to get on, you need to stay the right side of the prime minister. The prime minister, Rishi Sunak, is trying to hold together this rather fragile coalition within his own party. The party has brought in a lot of what you might call wet liberals, who are not conservatives by any stretch of the imagination, and they are very green, very behind net zero, and they threaten to cause trouble if there is even a hint that the government might go weak on the issue. So we've had warm words from the prime minister. We've had warm words from the energy secretary saying that, people need to be told the truth about, the cost of net zero. They've told us that we need to know it, and they're right. We do need to know it, but they will not tell us. They have not told us. We are now 6 months on from Rishi Sunak saying that, and he has done nothing about it in the interim. And the reason is, of course, that if people knew the true cost of net zero, we wouldn't be doing it, because it would be obvious that the net zero medicine was worse than the alleged climate change damage. They are just going to try and string this out until the election. And then, who knows what happens after that. Labour, we're going to get an election, pretty much by the end of the year. And the Labour Party, of course, are even worse. There is almost nobody within the Labour Party who asks any questions on this issue at all. Things are likely to get quite bad in the UK in the next few years. I think the Labour Party will then immediately run into issues with the costs, though. Within the first couple of the years, they will discover that there isn't any money to spend on all these big net zero promises that they and the Conservative Party are making. And then there will be a crisis, and who knows what happens then. Maybe sanity will return, but I'm not holding my breath.
All right, we're talking with Andrew Monford, director of Net Zero Watch in the UK, and author of The Hockey Stick Illusion, which shows you how, I don't know if you use the word scientific fraud, but you see how scientific manipulation occurs in climate as well as it did, obviously, during COVID. He didn't, but it's about Michael Mann's hockey stick. We'll be right back. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. I want to ask you about how net zero is going to play out, because this is a fairy tale they're dealing with as they impose this on Europeans. But we'll be right back after these messages.
Today's News Talk Radio.
I like hearing the news.
News. A lot of news.
TNT Radio News.
Top of the hour, every hour.
TNT.
The challenges our planet's animals are facing sometimes feel a bit heavy.
Animals haven't eaten in a day, 2 days. They haven't drank anything. They're cold. They're dehydrated.
As soon as we started our descent, everywhere I could see was mud. Just absolutely mud.
The country has been in prolonged drought so long. It was like a tinderbox waiting to go up.
Okay, very heavy. Each of us wants to be part of the solution. And we can be. Remember that there's good happening right now. At home.
All right, we were able to get into your unit and we have all four of your cats.
Okay. And around the world. For any animal in any disaster. So let's focus on that, right? Be part of the solution. One rescue at a time. Search ifa.org/disaster-ready.
On a virtual road, you can test the limits of your driving ability to see how fast you can go under the most extreme conditions, like when it's dark, when the weather's bad, or when the unexpected happens. The higher the speed, the harder the impact. But driving isn't a game or a race. When you're on the road, just 10 miles per hour over the limit can mean the difference between life and death. You're responsible for people's lives and your own. Slow down and save lives.
Examining the issues. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, we're talking with Andrew Monford, director of Net Zero Watch, and the climate skeptic group in the UK following this madness. All right, Andrew, there is a historian named Saul Friedlander who described 20th century totalitarian regimes as essentially enforcing magical beliefs through the bureaucracy. Does that apply to this whole net zero agenda? The idea that are these not magical beliefs that they're going to transform energy, transportation, food supply, and make this all like targets and some Soviet style plan and energy, everything's going to be cheaper and everyone's going to be prosperous and happy. How in the hell is this going to end? This is madness, what's happening in Europe and what's now US, of course, is following along, depending on our election cycle, of course. But where does this end? And where does this magical thinking end? How is it going to end? Because they can't actually do what they're talking about, because I don't think Europeans would even accept a moment of it.
No, I think that the we don't have the money to do the things that they say we need to do. In many cases, we don't have the technologies to do the things they say we need to do. For example, you know, there is still this black hole, if you like, over what we're going to do when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. I mean, the UK is supposed to run essentially largely off offshore wind farms. When the wind doesn't blow, what are we going to do? And they bandy around this word energy storage, but they don't tell you what the technology is, because as soon as they name a technology, you can point out to them that it's far too expensive. So batteries are just preposterously expensive. You know, we're talking trillions of pounds, and the batteries need to be replaced every 10 years. People talk about hydrogen, but you know, the technologies for if you want an engine to turn hydrogen back into electricity, well, you know, they haven't really been invented yet. You know, at least they haven't been deployed yet. It is completely magical thinking. We have no cost-benefit analysis. Now, I mean, to me, this is just the killer. This is what tells you that what they're doing is essentially irrational. They're saying we are going to do net zero no matter what, no matter the cost. We're not going to think about the cost. So they haven't prepared a cost-benefit analysis. The government has a set of official advisors on net zero called the Climate Change Committee, who are extremely dodgy, shall we say. You know, that you wouldn't trust them any further than you could throw them. And yeah, we managed to get their calculations of what the cost would be. They only looked at the costs, not the benefits. We got them under FOI after, you know, a year of battling through the courts. And the numbers are completely fictional. I mean, it was extraordinary. So one of the things that had jumped out at me when they published their report was that people were going to save money by shifting from internal combustion engine cars to electric cars. They were going to save money? How does that work? I mean, why wasn't it happening spontaneously? Okay, so you go, when we actually got hold of the calculations, the reason they came up with this was that they were assuming that an electric car was not much more than half the price of an internal combustion engine car. And what is more, they were assuming that that applied today at the time the report appeared. Now, you know, you and I know that if you go to a motor dealership, it's the other way around. You know, the electric car is much more expensive than the old fashioned one. So you know, this wasn't an accident. You know, you can't accidentally do that.
Yeah.
I'll tell you another story, because I like these stories, and it took me a lot of work to get the answers. So if the wind doesn't blow, right, you need a lot of storage. Okay. And you know, they were assuming that the storage was going to be hydrogen. The longer periods you get with no wind, the more hydrogen storage you need and the more expensive it gets. So they managed to get the cost down by assuming there basically wouldn't be any windless days in 2050. I mean, just absolutely extraordinary. I mean, people should be fired for this. They absolutely should, but they get away with it because the whole of the political and media establishment are just putting their hands in the air and saying, well, you know, this is what we want to do. We're going to do it anyway. They don't care. And it's absolutely shameful. And, you know, eventually the wheels will come off this, and then, you know, fingers will start to be pointed at the people who said these things. But, you know, I guess they all hope to be retired by then.
Yeah. Well, this is the intentional rationing of energy, food, transportation, freedom of movement. You have, as you mentioned, the billionaire class, the political class, the academic class, corporate media, the ruling class. Everyone is just all in on this, right? To hell. They just want to make it happen and everything will work out. We'll invent some technology that'll make it all happen. Don't worry. They're creating chaos intentionally. And all they're really doing is outsourcing European energy to China, which is going to have higher emissions per unit of energy. It's insane. So do the farmers' protests and the temporary halting of the Green New Deal, the elections coming up. How does this end? We have about, I think we only have about, you have about a minute left. How do you see this ending? I mean, you say, you know, these people, it'd be too expensive, but ultimately, is there going to be like riots and protests in the street and net zero is going to just die a quiet death? Or is it just going to, are they just going to keep pushing and pushing until you have societal collapse of energy, food, transportation?
Okay, my bet on this is that because we're British and we don't really do protests quite as well as people like the French, it'll probably be like this. What will happen? The Conservatives will go into the next election and will get wiped out. Labour will get into power and it will be a mess because the money's been spent, and so they can't spend all the money they need. They will then fall apart. And I think what may happen is that the Conservative Party in opposition will reform themselves and go, okay, now we need to start being serious about this and take a look at what we can do differently. And at that point, I think we will turn away from net zero. Probably not in the headlines, but it in practice. Yeah, we'll say we're still doing it, but we're just going to take a bit longer about it, and then it'll be kicked into the long grass and we'll carry on.
Okay, well, that's one way, I hope. I was hoping for something a little more dramatic, but all right, we're out of time. Andrew Mofford, director of Net Zero Watch, thank you for joining the show today. Unleashed with Mark Marano. We'll see you in the next. Stay tuned.